Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. Earlier this year, the American Committee of the International Press Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism sponsored a conference for small newspapers in the Midwest on how to make international news a good local story. The idea was that news far away had a serious impact on our day-to-day lives wherever we were. Yesterday, the cost of gasoline at pumps here in Columbia went up by 12 cents a gallon. That's almost 10%. The reason? Political unrest in Venezuela and the possibility of a coming war in Iraq. They are two major oil-producing nations. And Sunday, the New York Times reported exclusively that President Bush had approved an expansion of the CIA's right to assassinate specific al-Qaeda terrorist leaders without getting his permission. That would seem to mean the CIA may range anywhere in the world to do its work, raising a lot of difficult problems. For example, the CIA used a drone airplane to attack and kill an al-Qaeda leader in North Yemen earlier this year. Yemen is an important American ally these days. Should this country be violating the sovereignty of other countries around the world in the hunt for terrorists? Those are today's subjects, and here to discuss them are Alexander Merkushev, a producer for Associated Press Television in Moscow, Sonovia Casas, a political journalist for the newspaper El Nacional in Caracas, Venezuela, and in Washington, Andy Buncombe of the British newspaper The Independent, and Howard LaFranchi, foreign affairs reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Let's start with the question of assassination. Alexander Merkushev, Russia has many problems involving Chechen leaders, and I get the feeling that there is a program of assassination by the Russian government of Chechen leaders going on. Has there been any discussion of what the United States is planning to do?
Well, so far there's been no discussion about the decision taken in the United States, but the very report about this sent creepers along many spines in Russia, because this reminds us of the situation that existed in the former Soviet Union under Stalin and later on when Russia's and Soviet special forces assassinated defectors, dissidents inside the Soviet Union and even abroad where they went hiding. But on the other hand, quite recently, a very well-known rebel leader, Salman Raduyev, just died under mysterious circumstances in prison after he was sent to serve a life sentence there. So we are really worried in Russia. I mean, the democratic community is really worried both about developments in Russia and about decisions that question America's adherence to democracy.
Andy Buncombe, Howard LaFranchi, how was this story treated among journalists in Washington? Was there a lot of follow-up to it, Andy? Howard? Howard, go ahead.
After you. Well, I don't know if Andy would agree, but I think partially there's a, and this may be seen as semantics, but of course, the White House made the point that that the president did not waive the ban on or did not waive the executive order against assassinations, and the White House is saying that really what is new here is a list of particular what they call war combatants. And that it's not assassinations, but that these are soldiers of the enemy in a war. And so I think one thing that there was a feeling that, and this dates actually back from a decision that was made following September 11th. I think what's new, particularly here, is the list with the al-Qaeda names on it, and I do think there was also some discussion of just how public that list should have been made and what impact that might have in the war on terrorism.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, the list was not made public.
It's a secret list, yes, but some names seem to have got out.
Yeah. Does this not seem to be contrary to principles of the American legal system and legality in a democracy? Andy, what do you think?
Well, I think two points. I'd agree with Howard on his analysis of its impact in Washington. You'll remember that President Gerald Ford, back in 1976, actually introduced an executive order, an executive fiat, I think was the phrase, to ban assassinations or targeted killings. That was done amid growing concern that the CIA was becoming something of a law unto itself in its efforts in the Cold War. I think Howard raised an interesting point when he questioned whether these were assassinations and rather than targeted killing, and also raised the use of the word enemy combatant. I think there have been a number of instances since September the 11th in which the administration has gone through some legal loopholes in order to pursue the war on terror. I'm thinking primarily of the people at Guantanamo Bay who've been there for almost a year now. None have been charged, none have been put before a judge. Questions about due process, and this has been allowed under American law because of the terminology that's been used. So, I think questions are being raised, have been raised, and continue to be raised about the legitimacy of the Bush approach.
Yes, I think that it's certainly by certain critics or skeptics may be seen in terms of issues of due process, fairness, and democratic principles. On the other hand, as I said, this policy which followed September 11th, part of it was used in conjunction with the war in Afghanistan and the idea of how do you go out or go about taking out people like Osama bin Laden, for example, who are, it's a question that there's someone who's a prominent individual, someone, in fact, looked up to by many people around the world, and it's hard to see how that would not be an assassination. And so I think the point of the policy was, some might call it fudging, but to how do you get at the enemies you feel you have to without completely not only going against principles, but waiving that the order against assassinations, which I think was seen that would have caused even more of an uproar.
Yeah, this is all being treated as a new phenomenon, but yet one recalls 35 years ago, the effort to assassinate Che Guevara, which ended up in an assassination in Bolivia, if I recall properly.
One thing, this is Andrew here. One thing I think is quite telling, and one thing I think that we perhaps has emerged from this as well, is that I don't think this does the Bush administration any harm whatsoever. To the contrary, I'm sure that they're very happy that this message is out, and that they're getting their message very clearly out to terrorists that we can get you. You'll remember just last month the killing of an al-Qaeda, senior al-Qaeda operative in Yemen that was carried out with a Predator drone and a Hellfire missile attached to that drone that was dispatched from Djibouti. It was done in the very most public way. The story was passed on to the press within 24 hours. A great deal of detail was immediately available, and I think the message was being sent out very clear. You can run, but you can't hide, and we will catch you. And now, further to that, we have a list of the people we're after. So I think a very strong message from the Bush administration to those people that we're on your case.
Yeah, do you get the feeling that the Bush administration is getting any closer to even finding Osama bin Laden? The president hasn't mentioned that name in, I think, 7 or 8 months now.
No, we were told clearly a number of months ago, we were told that he was not the he was not the issue. That's not the clearly they sort of moved on. And someone else join in, please. But I would say there's I see little indication at all that they're that they either are or feel any closer to getting him.
Andy, do you have anything you want to say about that?
Well, again, I think Howard's spot on. They haven't been talking about him. Mr. Bush barely bring himself to use his name. I think it was very telling. It was very telling when the last the tape came out. I think about a month ago, the latest tape, which seems to suggest that Bin Laden's alive. I've seen contrary reports out of Switzerland, where voice analysts there say that they've raised doubts about this. At the same time, I don't think we can joke about this. Yeah, the war on terror is moving in different directions, and it is looking at different targets. But let's not fool ourselves with the totemic power that Bin Laden would have. And every time the suggestion that he's still alive, I think it's a real kick in the stomach to America and to the West. And I think that Mr. Bush would like nothing more than for one of those Hellfire missiles to find its way to Mr. Bin Laden.
Yes, we can rest assured that the day he was eliminated, to use a somewhat sanitized term, but that it would be it wouldn't be played in the back pages, and it would be, of course, touted as a huge coup, a huge victory.
Right. Okay, we have to take a break now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 573-882-9641. Before the break, we were talking about the war against terrorism. There is another huge story going on, and it has been going on for weeks in Venezuela, where protesters of the government of Cesar Chavez have been in the streets and have been on strike and have been bringing that economy, the oil industry, to a serious halt. Sonovia Casas, bring us up to date, please, on what is happening in Venezuela and what the outlook is.
Oh, yes. At the beginning of the program, you talked about that the gas in your state has gone up 12 cents. Well, today, on the Thursday, here in Caracas and in almost all the country, we have no gas. And we are the fifth producer of the OPEC. This is a serious problem. This is one of the one of the most important parts of this conflict, because the country will not be able, as you said, it's in halt. And in the political side, we don't see the parts moving forward to find a political solution that one of the biggest parts of the country, the opposition sector, is asking for, that it's elections now. And yesterday evening, Secretary General of the OAS, Cesar Gaviria, presented to the parts, to the government and to the opposition in the dialogue, in the desk of dialogue, in what we call the parts are coming together to talk here in Caracas, his proposition. And he didn't ask, he didn't present it to them a electoral solution. And some people from the opposition had said that they are not very happy because of this. So the tension is going up. We are almost how many days from Christmas, and there is no sentiment, no feeling of Christmas here in Caracas or in the rest of the country. The opposition, it's growing more and more, and the president has not said anything about, complying what the opposition wants.
The opposition wants an immediate election, is that correct? And Chavez does not really have to hold an election until next August. The compromise would be somewhere in between those two dates, is that right?
Yes, they have come with, yesterday they presented to Gaviria a proposition of elections in April. That is going to be between of what the opposition wants, that it's now, and what President Chavez is asking for, that's August. President Chavez has said that what he wants is a revocatory referendum, that it's in our constitution. That is what he has stand for, and he has not moved from there, not even in the last 2 months that this crisis has going on.
Yeah. What's happening in Venezuela, of course, has implications around the world. In Russia, it helps the Russians, I think, to sell more oil internationally. Here in the United States, as I mentioned earlier, it is having an impact in rising gasoline prices. Howard LaFranchi, what about Washington? Is Washington doing anything to try to help resolve this crisis?
Well, I think, in fact, I just have a story on Washington in this crisis in today's Monitor, but Washington has been particularly awkward on this crisis, which actually has been going on for more than just a few months. You may recall that in April. President Chavez was briefly ousted just for a two-day period, during that time, at that time, the U.S. Very quickly came out and sounded very favorable to that ouster, which raised all kinds of alarms around Latin America, because it looked like the U.S. was back to its old practice of favoring or siding with coups that acted against elected leaders, and the U.S. Quickly tried to repair the damage it had done. Then you fast forward to the crisis now, and just last Friday, the White House came out and said that they supported early elections, and that gave an opportunity to President Chavez to say, well, there's the White House asking me to go against my own constitution, because the constitution doesn't allow for early elections. It allows for what Chavez is saying is a revocatory referendum in August. And so then the White House came out again and say, well, yes, of course, we're not asking anyone to do anything any country to do anything against its constitution. But I think what we're seeing here, as in other areas of foreign policy, but a split in the Bush administration. You have a few mostly conservative political appointees who would very much like a very a much tougher line against Hugo Chavez. But clearly the administration is focused on Iraq and the war on terrorism, and would really not have to deal with a crisis on the back doorstep, as they say. And so you have another part of the administration just saying, you know, we can't get too involved. This is great that the OIS is taking this on. Let's just kind of let this one ride out. And so you have that tension within the administration that's playing out in what looks like not very coherent U.S. policy.
Andy Bunkum, how is this crisis being treated in Western Europe?
Well, viewed with concern, I think, viewed with great concern, and I don't think purely from the perspective of how it affects oil prices. I think Howard was very, very, very telling in his points earlier, and very precise about the way in which the administration in Washington has been interfering with this, and the fears and the concerns that sparked across Latin America when it did. Back in early this year, I think it also shows, as well, on a more global level, how interconnected we all are these days, and how things across the other side of the world have not just ripple effects but severe effects. We've talked about oil prices. We've talked about the way this is being viewed in Washington. The sense of concern in Western European capitals. And as you started the section of the program saying, in Russia, the effect it has on the sale of oil. So I'm intrigued by the way that something that can happen in South America has a huge and very telling effect. So absolute concern, yes. And I think the sooner the a sense of calm can be brought to this situation, I think everyone will be happier.
Alexander Merkushev, is there any chance that the Russian oil interests are going to take advantage of this situation?
Well, I think that, you know, geographically Venezuela is very far from Russia, but there are many people and politicians in Russia who feel affinity with many Latin American countries, especially Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, so they want the crisis to end as soon as possible. On the other hand, many Russian politicians, government officials, and of course oil producers privately express their, you know, interest and satisfaction with the crisis in such faraway countries, which do not directly affect Russia's interest, but they help keep the oil prices high. And Russia is facing huge payments under its foreign debt next year, so it's very much in the interest of the Russian government to see international crises developing, well, better far from its borders, so that there is tension in the world and the price of oil is high, so that oil proceeds are great and enough to pay off foreign debts.
Sounds like what you're saying is that Russia does not want to produce and export more oil to bring the price of oil back down.
Well, it's a very big issue. You never know which is the best way. I mean, the more oil you produce, it's very difficult to, you know, manipulate oil production when there are so many players on the market, some of them grouped in the OPEC, some of them not there. So, you know, the Russian government never knows which is the best deal for it, you know, to increase oil production or to cut it. You cut oil production, you immediately lose a lot of money, and you don't really think about long-term effects in the ever-changing market and political situation.
This is Howard. I think that's right. I think a lot of countries, even within OPEC, are saying, "Well, this is a political matter. This is a strike, and we might move in the direction of increasing production." But, you know, there's a certain amount of time in any pipeline like that, and it might all be resolved. And Venezuela being as close as it is and providing normally about 14% of U.S. oil needs, this might be all settled by the time we would actually be geared up to provide more oil. So I think there's not a great rush to fill that gap right now.
Sonovia Casas, last night on one of the television news reports in this country, it was said that Venezuela is sinking toward the possibility of civil war. Yet the demonstrations so far have been relatively peaceful. Is there a danger of a serious deterioration?
Yes, there is a danger of deterioration and of a severe deterioration if the parts don't come with a political and negotiated solution. But the Venezuelans, yesterday we had here in Caracas a situation where the Chavistas and the opposition people were playing soccer. There was a situation here, what it was called. They stopped the traffic, and they put like some barricades in some of the streets. And the Chavistas and the opposition people were confronted, and to move forward, to not to create a conflict, what they did in one of the parts of the city was to play soccer. So, as you see, we still have a humor, and we still have the spirit of the need to reconcile and to find our a way to our conflict in a pacific way. even though we are under a severe tension because the food is not going to the markets because we don't have gas, and because we are going to have a Christmas, a very sad Christmas this year, because what people are asking, and I am not in the opposition sector, I'm an independent journalist, but I am seeing as a Venezuelan that public opinion in the international community is really not understanding us in our all dimension, because when we say that we want a solution, Gaviria has back most of the claims when he says that yes, we have to find a solution in the constitution, but we have to be flexible and creative. And President Chavez 3 years ago said that if the people ask him to resign because the people didn't want him, then he will do it. And what people in Venezuela is asking Chavez is to count himself in the polls. If he has the power, if he is a legitimate and democratic president, then why he is not in this moment saying, yes, I'm going to be counted in the polls, and I want to be reinstated as a democratic and elected president. And this cannot be seen as anti-democratic when people in Venezuela is claiming this. This cannot be seen as another coup like in April. This has to be seen as the what people want. This is what he created. He created a democratic system where the people had to participate. This is one of the most important things that Chavez has given to the Venezuelans.
If I may interrupt you, we have about a minute left. You raise an interesting question. Have there been any good social science polls, any Gallup-type polls, which show how popular Chavez is?
Well, yes, but not in the last 3 weeks or 4 weeks. What we have seen in the polls is that he has lost his popular support. Chavez won with more than 60%, and in a revocatory referendum, he had wants to be ousted of power by a revocatory referendum. Yeah, the candidate of the opposition has to get more than 60%, right? That is what our constitution says. Well, right now he doesn't have 60%. Probably he has like 30% or 20%, and he's going down. And the people that is with Chavez is the people that have never had anything in a democratic system. It's the people that are poor and that are supporting him because he put them in the map, because he made these people important for a democratic system. That's also his favorite.
Zenobia, I'm sorry, but that has to be the last word. We are out of time. Our guests today have been Andy Buncom and Howard LaFranchi in Washington, Zenobia Casas in Caracas, Venezuela, and Alexander Merkushev in Moscow. Our director is Pat Akers, and our producer, Colleen Stachura. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.